Good morning, everyone. Today is September 1st. You're at the Board of Supervisors. It's 9 a.m. If everyone could please stand for the pledge and then remain standing afterwards, and we will have our invocation by Reverend Rick Fritzmeyer from the Youth for Christ.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Bow with me, if you would, please. Gracious Father, we thank you for this day and for this gathering of these folks that you have put into place of authority. And we would just thank you for their wisdom, for their desire to serve their fellow man, and you give them great insight today in the matters before them, that they would serve and lead in ways that would be pleasing to you. Watch over each one of them. Watch over our great community and our great county. In your name we pray. Amen.
Thank you, Rick. Good luck with the leg there. Okay, I think we have an item that's too late for the agenda, so I think we need to start first and get authorization for this. Yeah, should we go to public comment first, or should we? Okay, all right. We're going to do that after public comment. So we will start with public comment. And the first card that we have here is going to be Carmen Sabatino. Carmen, just before you start today, if we could, you know, I know very much respect, you know, everybody's right to their free speech here and everything that's done. And I know that you feel very strongly about what you've been talking about, what you talked about last week. And I just want to remind you to please, you know, watch your language here.
Excuse me. Is there anything in particular about my language that is upsetting you?
There was a word that you said last time. Maybe you don't remember saying it, but that was very inappropriate for here, and I just would appreciate
you. Okay. Would you communicate that to me in an email, and I will correct that?
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
Is that fair?
Good to see you.
Okay. You know, I have sent I'm all through already. You know, first I get my candidate Satan censored and all this. Anyhow, I have sent a letter to the Attorney General in relation to the Corey Kaufman case. I don't know how many of you know. Do you remember the Corey Kaufman case? Because that's been turned into the Frank Carson case. But and if I'm saying something inappropriate, the county council, you might want to advise me on that. I'm not going to cover that today. You will get a copy of that communication. But I do have a list, and if I want to just take a few minutes. I don't think this is going to be offensive, but the list comprises the names of 58 people who are cold homicide cases with the district attorney's office. I don't want to go all the way back, but if I could go back just 10 years. Vladimir Rojas, a juvenile, 2008. Christopher Sisk, 2007. Michael Itarib, 2007. Jamie Garcia, 2007. Paul Barraza, 2005. Thomas Lineback, that goes back to 1993, I'm sure that's. Sabrina Ordez, 2005. And let me stop and tell you where I'm coming from here. These are people who have not received justice, because we've had a district attorney's office who does not address itself to legitimate crime, okay, and instead goes on their way with the cases that we've seen here in the last few years, especially in which Mr. Carson was a defense attorney. Omar Mendoza, 2013, Donnie Ray Coyle, 2012, Damian King, 2012, Amador Molina, 2012, Amy Fresha, 2001, Michael Strong, 2010, Andre Garcia, 2010, and then there's a string of ones of 2014. Now, I don't know how they got the cold case list, but they're probably still open, and the results aren't in. Michael John Silveira, Richard Frank Bernal, Robert Ross, who was stabbed to death on the street in Oakdale, Richard Ware, Stephen Miller, Teresa Unsing, these are all 2014, Oscar Nunez, Alejandro Maldonado, 2014, Manuel De Silva, 2014, Dylan Gilmer Reynolds, 2014, Teresa Provincio, 2013. Juan Calvillo, 2014. Johanna Walls, 2005. Jose Hurtado, 2009. George Betancourt, 2011. Betty Ellenberg, an elder, 2005. Roy McLean, 2010. There's one in here. Donna Peoples. I don't know if Donna has given up. Hers goes back to 1975. And as recently as 3 years ago, I remember seeing her at all the victim programs with pictures of her daughter. These are people who are not receiving justice from the district attorney's office in this county. I can hardly wait till the next election. Thank you.
Thanks, Carmen. Okay, next up, Susan Beasley. Susan, how are you?
Good morning. Good morning, everyone. I am here at my annual invitation to my community, to all of you as Board of Supervisors and leaders of our community, and to those in the audience and throughout Stanislaus County, to invite you to the 24th International Heritage Festival, taking place Saturday, October 3rd. We will again be over at MJC East Campus on College Avenue. And this was started many, many years ago by a committee. Kenny Friedman was involved, Carol Whiteside, and many other community leaders, and we've been able to continue on with it. We invite you to join us, bring your families. It's an excellent opportunity to learn about heritage all from all over the world, but also to celebrate our American heritage, which is what ties us all together. Again, we'll have an 11 a.m. opening ceremony with a just beautiful, colorful parade of flags. We have lots of different countries who will be there. Kids World will again be there for the kids and for the kid in you. We hope to see you making your paper hats, hope to see you making your masks from around the world and having a good time with us and learning with your passport activities. And again, we'll have a booth for the USA, which will be presented by the Civil Air Patrol, the youth group there. That'll challenge you to name all 50 states and the capitals. So I want to see how many of you know all the 50 states and all the capitals, which you should have learned right about fourth or fifth grade. And if you were in Mrs. S's class at Garrison School the way I was, you learned about that. You learned the Gettysburg Address. You learned the history of our country and all those wonderful things that bring us all together. So again, it's Saturday, October 3rd. It's International Heritage Festival number 24. Food, fun, music all day long. Please join us. If you're going to be there, we'd like to know so that we can properly introduce you. And fun learning about history and geography. And also just a quick plug for our international, I call it an international architecture festival, because it's doing so wonderful. And that's going to be starting up in a couple weeks, I believe September 12th. where children are learning about science, technology through fun activities right in front of our library. So do hope to see you, and I do have some flyers. And please invite all of our community, and we hope to have you and your family. And Vito, I notice you're not making eye contact because you still owe me the Star Spangled Banner on the trumpet.
So you remember, I remember.
I remember. So we would love to have you perform. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Susan.
She knows.
Okay, that's all that I have cards for, except we have a couple items that are attached to agenda items, so we'll get to those. Any other public comment? Anybody else have anything else they'd like to talk about, something that's not on the agenda? Okay, we will. No, we'll get to you when we come to that, Mr. Sell. Yeah. Okay, we'll move on to our consent calendar. Stan, do you want to jump in before?
Yeah, Chair and board members, we'd like to ask that you add an item to your agenda this morning as a matter too late for the agenda. Last Friday, we had a significant breakdown of our electrical systems out at County Center 2. The repairs can be fairly extensive and need to be done immediately. So we would ask that you put on the agenda a matter that would declare an emergency in accordance with public contract code. And a copy of that agenda has been provided to you this morning.
Okay. So, Jack, go ahead.
Yeah, and I'll clarify that specifically you need to make findings that, one, the need to take there's a need to take immediate action, and second is that the need for that action arose after the agenda was posted on Friday. We believe that both those conditions can be met.
Okay, so do we do this now then, authorize this?
Yes.
Okay, so we need a motion to authorize to add this.
And to be clear, you're just authorizing it to be put on the agenda, and I would request that you consider that as item B8.
Okay, so do we have a motion to authorize?
Motion to authorize the addition of B8.
Very good. We have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Passes 5-0. This will be item B8. Okay. Very good. Now we will move to the consent calendar. Any item? Okay. I think we're going to come to it as item B8 after. Is that okay? Okay. Okay, we'll go ahead and we'll go forward. So, consent calendar. Any item that anyone would like to pull from the consent calendar? Anyone in the audience like to pull on the consent? Okay. Do we have a motion for consent?
So move.
We have a motion, second. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Passes 5-0. Moving on to item A2. Lee Lundgren. Hi, Lee.
Good morning to the board. This morning, I'm Lee Lundgren, County Clerk Recorder, Registrar of Voters, and Commissioner of Civil Marriage. I'm here today to discuss the acceptance by this board, who is the governing board, for the Burbank Paradise Fire Protection District. They held a special election on last Tuesday, August 25th. I'm here to present to you the results of that and have you declare it. The Burbank Paradise Fire Protection District has 2,698 voters. We sent ballots to each of them. 317 voters voted. It was a required 67% vote, and they got a 68.14. And that's pretty much all the result information that we have at this point in time. A couple other things I wanted to just bring your attention to. We had a training last Friday for voter registration drives. I wanted to thank our supervisor, Jim DeMartini, for attending that, and a lot of other interested people in the community who would like to conduct voter registration drives were there, about 25 people. And that was a kind of a fun thing to put on for everybody. And then we have the UDEL election coming up on November 3rd. That is the consolidated district election. And I do have some information on that to let the board know. First of all, just for an FYI, there are 435 elected officials in Stanislaus County. Of those, there is going to be, in this next election, 113 polling places, and approximately 174,955 as of now, hopefully more by then, people who will be able to vote in that consolidated district election. Just to clarify, that is an election that we hold as a county for various districts and allow them to consolidate with it so they can hold their own specials, they can consolidate with the one that is going to be taken for president or gubernatorial, but this is one that is special just for local. And not everyone in the county will be voting because not everything is going to election. So, a little clarification there. There will be 31 ballot types, 67 candidates, 24 different races, and 6 municipal measures on the UDEL election. Any questions?
Very good. Thanks, Lee. Any questions of Lee?
Exactly. Could you just repeat how many people are going to be voting as compared to what the total county vote would be in a general election?
Are we talking the UDEL?
Yeah, the UDEL.
Yes. The general county right now has 214,572 people who are registered to vote and 174,955 will have authority to vote in the UDEL because they're going to election.
Okay.
The size is quite amazing if you saw it on a map. It's just a small portion is going of the physical size of the county, but it's most of the voters. So,
yeah.
Got a lot of area with farmland in it that doesn't have a lot of people.
Yeah, that's more than I thought it would be.
Yeah.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, I know I have one card, Pam Hiller. Pam would like to address the election, discuss the election. Pam, how are you?
I'm good, and I'd like to thank the Board of Supervisors for allowing this. We just wanted, as a fire district, to thank some employees of the county that we feel made this so much easier for us. It was a pretty rough road. We did not hire an agency to hold our hand through this. We did everything. It was about a 3.5-year project for us, and I had us on the wrong path that could have been questioned in court for about 2 years, and my husband and one of the county councils were able to get us on the right path, and so there were a couple other people too. So I gave your secretary a copy of a letter that we did, but just in short, my husband, who's the chief of the department, wanted me to thank Supervisor DeMartini, who came out and met with him over some of these things. At one time, Supervisor DeMartini actually had part of our district, and when my husband reached out to him, he thought that was still the case and found out that it was still very helpful, the input that you had and also the encouragement. So he wanted me to thank you. He had to leave. He had jury duty. So on my part, I do kind of like the tax roll administration type of thing. And Kathleen Stiles, who is a candidate services unit with the Stanislaus County Clerk Recorder Elections Division, she was extremely helpful. She kept just held my hand literally through making sure that we got everything publicized and everything on time. Janet Sledgers Davenport with the Property Tax Division, she's another one. She knew well in advance that we were going to be doing this, and we had to actually do her process 3 times because we weren't really sure how the election was going to come out. So, and again, she helped us hugely. And then last but not least, our superhero that, again, really, really helped us. We wouldn't have done it and would not have been successful without him, is Deputy County Counsel Thomas Bowes. He not only researched and found things that we weren't able to find because he's much smarter, but he also attended meetings and really was there for us and in making sure that we got everything done, and we just can't thank him enough. so much for all that he did to help us. So unfortunately, we are already being reached out by other districts that want to know how we did what we did. The only other thing that we did was we went out and we went face to face with all the residents, which sadly, we had a very small percentage show up with their ballots, but I think the ones that voted for it were the ones that we actually got to talk to. So thank you so much. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Congratulations on your election. And Lee, thank you. Any other comments, Lee, before you?
No, I have no more comments. I'm just waiting for your decision.
Okay. So do we have a motion to accept the results?
So moved.
Second.
And a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Passes 5-0.
Thank you very much.
No. Okay. We will move on to item B7. Madeline.
Good morning, Chairman Withrow, Supervisors, Mr. Risen, Mr. Doring, Dr. Madeline Schlepfer, Director of Behavioral Health and Recovery Services. This morning I'm joined by Dan Rosas, who will be doing the PowerPoint clicker. I also want to thank Dan. He was so much involved in getting all this put together. It's a very long journey getting these things put together, and I really appreciate his help for that. Okay, ready. I think that this quote was one that had been part of our planning process, and I thinking that it really kind of captures captures what we do in Stanislaus County, and I really appreciate that. Again, I just want to kind of briefly go through very quickly, you know, because a lot of it, as you're well aware of, we have the five components of the MHSA. Next, we have a plan update that's required when we make changes to the annual update. So as you recall, in June of 2015, we came to you with the annual update. And since we did not, you know, unfortunately we'd like to do it once a year, but one of the problems is that we don't really know, given how the money comes in now, exactly what we're dealing with. And as you recall, this is one of those that has a reversion on it. If you don't use the money, it goes back to the state. So it began another planning process, which led to the plan update, which I'm presenting to you today. So all the plan updates have to be approved by the board, and then once adopted, we have to send them to the Mental Health Services Oversight and Accountability Commission, which coincidentally ended up here visiting us last week and had very complimentary things to say about our process here in Stanislaus County. This was the first time that they were outside of Sacramento, and I think it's their intent to do this more often, just to have kind of a real hands-on view of what goes on, especially with the innovation project. They did visit one of our current innovation projects, and we're very pleased with that, especially that the outcomes are turning out very well. They will be the final authority on approving our innovation piece of this plan update. Just to remind again, in I think it was late January, early February, I came to each board member and asked what your priorities would be for this money. And these were the summary of what we were given. Now, what we do is then with the planning for the plan update is that's part of all of our stakeholder processes. So they know what the board priorities are going forward. They also have done their own kind of prioritization for the funding. And so, again, it's really kind of meshing together the two of them so that we meet the board priorities as well as the representative stakeholder steering committee priorities, which is a very diverse group of individuals. My intent is that this will be an annual event with the board before we start our annual update planning again, which will probably start again in January, to meet with the board prior to this to see if there are changes in the priorities. So today, we start with the plan update highlights. Again, this is just a little bit of information on community services and supports, which I'm sure you're familiar with. Wanted to bring back the slides that we had presented in June, having to do with the total outcomes for all of the FSPs. And as you can see, there's a tremendous decrease, and in the outcomes, the fiscal part also is down, is up, in that we look at how much is saved by the FSP. So again, since an FSP is one of the plans that we're presenting today, I did want to bring this back to the attention. Okay, so let's start with the first one, which is the FSP for children and youth. We have an FSP for youth, though they must be involved with the criminal justice system. I am going to ask, as soon as I kind of just briefly go through this, it's going to target kids with severe problems. Our hope is that we've had in the past year a significant increase in youth requiring hospitalization, and we really need to get something happening to lower that. So our hope is that the FSP, because that's what's happened with the adults, that the adult FSPs, is that we've seen a tremendous decrease in that. At this time, just to kind of give it the hands-on view for you, I'd like to have my chief of children's services, system of care, and our transitional age youth, Shannon McDonald, come up and kind of just talk about both the FSP and also the innovation project, which I will kind of have some closing comments on.
Good morning, Chairman Withrow, Mr. Risen, supervisors, and Mr. Doring. I wanted to take a minute to share with you what the vision is around the FSP. We currently, as Madeline said, do have an FSP for probation. However, children do have to be involved in the probation system in order to have access to 24/7 mental health services through that particular FSP. With children who are involved in child welfare systems, we have, the KDA lawsuit out of LA that we most recently implemented Pathways to Well-Being to be a 24/7 response for those children as well. The one area that we see that we do not have access for children is our community as a whole not connected to any other part of a system in this county. Our everyday kids who are walking through having struggles, maybe in school, schools are identifying them. We don't have an avenue for them to have that 24/7 service. We're looking at this FSP to be more of prevention, keeping children out of hospitals. As you may know, there are a limited number of children's beds for psychiatric placement in the state of California, and all counties are vying for those same very beds. Unfortunately, those beds are not in Stanislaus County and require us to transport children by ambulance to as far out as LA, Bakersfield, Sacramento, Fremont, San Francisco. Families do not get to go with their children. We have children. We've had one very young, and children under the age of 7. There are no beds, and only in LA do we have beds. This FSP would address children 6 to 17. It would really focus on the prevention of keeping those kids in a service that's 24/7 to support families. It would also address homelessness, which is an issue. When parents become homeless, children become more escalated. This FSP will focus on working with families to find housing and employment to stabilize family units so that children are less likely to become in crisis. The other part of this is the SIP, and the SIP would be a four-chair, not a facility, but an intervention. It would also be 24/7. We would have parent mentors and parent partners, if you will, that would help the families immediately upon their arrival to the SIP. They would have mentors for the children, other children maybe through our transitional age program or other parts of our system who have been in the system, children who are struggling, and that mentoring piece coming together. We would also have an early intervention, behavioral intervention for families and children. As it is currently, children are left sitting in emergency waiting rooms or emergency hallways after they've been assessed, sometimes days at a time with no intervention. They are clogging up the hallways, not by their choice certainly, but because of the rest of the state having difficulty finding beds for children. So there's no treatment being provided to them currently. We would like to intervene with that much more quickly and be able to provide an intervention once that they come to the hospital, you know, them being evaluated more immediately, and being able to come over to the SIP and have intervention much more quickly, thereby keeping families here, not causing trauma to children. It's very traumatizing to go in an ambulance hundreds of miles away to a facility where you know no one, you don't know what to expect, not always the best of behaviors learned while in the hospital, even though it is for treatment. And families, we then pay for families to have transportation to pick them and their child up to bring them back. What we're hoping to do is circumvent all of that outside piece whenever whenever needed, or families are willing, to at least impact the number of children being hospitalized by 50%. That is our hope. We would like to bring that number down. Children in Stanislaus County should stay in Stanislaus County and receive treatment here with their families and stay together as a family unit. Do you have any questions?
Any questions?
How many children from Stanislaus County are being hospitalized? I mean, how many do we have today?
Currently in the hospital today? I would have to check numbers, but our numbers run anywhere between 4 and 12 children in the hospital.
Okay, and this FSP will accommodate 24 children?
It will, and the idea is that this is a level of care system, so this would be the highest level of intervention. And as kids become more stable with their families and we've addressed some of those crisis issues, they would then move into a mental health team, and then once that they then became even more stable, we move them into a wellness level.
That's why you need 24 beds, because you're going to continue moving them down?
Correct, and it's not beds. It's just the slots. And we would look to continue as it is a way for children in crisis to move through levels of care much more quickly.
Okay. Any other questions? Go ahead.
So overall, this is potentially a $2 million.
I'm going to get to
okay.
That.
Well, then, I just, the question would be, though, with the out-of-county placements, the costs associated with everything, is this a net savings, a net cost to provide a better service? What are we looking at, or what is the expectation?
Well, I think the expectation is, on our part, it is definitely better service. You have children who are not being traumatized. We're trying to keep them out of the system for long periods of time. We believe that if we have more immediate intervention and we avoid hospitalization, then we may have children who are in the system much less time than they are currently.
Okay, I think
there's two parts to this. First of all, the figures you have are 3 years, over 3 years, and just moving ahead with the innovation piece. Skip ahead several. Go ahead.
Before you go ahead, I want to go back to this, because
Jeremy
didn't see my light on.
Go for it, Jim.
This expenditure seems questionable to me. You don't have the cost broke down between each one of these, and this one that you call the FSP, this 24 children you want to serve. Just what would you expect the cost of that to be?
Okay, the FSP itself, over 3 years, unfortunately, it's an RFP that'll be handling both the FSP and the innovation. But the projection is up to $2 million $2,012,913 over 3 years, so that's about $650,000 for each year for the FSP. For the innovation piece, that's 1.2 for 3 years, so that's $400,000 each year. So it's about $1 million each year.
That just seems unacceptable to me, this kind of money. You know, the children that are here, I couldn't hear exactly the numbers, but it seemed like it was somewhere like 4 or 5 or 6 children moved out of the county.
And each day.
They are taken care of. I'm going to go back to this a little bit more. Because we used to own the mental health facility before a tenant bought it. And so the amount of children coming in that thing was very little. And finally, the unit was closed because of lack of use.
Correct.
And now you want to bring something like that back, and I just don't see that there's any need for it.
No, we're not bringing hospitalization back. We're bringing prevention. So I go back to the FSP slides that you had earlier where you're saving in hospital days almost $4 million a year with the diversion of the FSPs we currently have. So our thought, here we're asking for an FSP, which is an outpatient treatment. It's not inpatient. It's to take the most severely ill children who are frequently going into the hospital and costing a lot of money, both in transportation by ambulance, and the number of days they spend in the hospital. We don't have control over them. Once they get in the hospital, the best we do is try to make sure they get released timely, but we're not in charge of that. So we're comparing that to $650,000 a year for an FSP that would have up to 24 kids at any one time. That's not 24 kids for a year, but that's up to 24. It's a staffing ratio issue. The crisis intervention program, which is the innovation piece of this, is again more in the prevention, early intervention piece of trying to keep them from again going out of the county, out to hospitals, and to try to make sure they're not traumatized further by having to be transported. So the savings that I don't have the savings up there for our current adult SIP. It has saved a lot of hospitalizations for adults. So we're asking for an innovation project for youth so that they also, we don't have to put them in the hospital. So every day we avoid hospitalization is a savings by something that is much less costly. So they're not hospitalization. We're not bringing any hospital back. We want to reduce it. Who knows why the volume of admissions has gone up? You're right. At the end, we couldn't keep it open. We had 15 beds there. You know, it gets a little less in the summertime, but when kids start going back to school, up go the hospitalizations for a variety of reasons. So I believe that we're doing something that ultimately is cost effective. Now, the SIP is an innovation. If it doesn't work out, it doesn't continue to be funded. The FSP is more of a permanent one, but there's definitely going to be outcomes, and we're expecting the outcomes to be as good as they are for adults.
Question.
And how many children, again, do you say this $2 million is going to take care of?
Okay, so the $2 million for the FSP over 3 years, so we have 24 slots. So let's say they stay there for 6 months. Well, that could be 48. It's hard to come up with exact, but just say worst case scenario is in a year you serve 24. So we're talking about three times that over 3 years. So these, again, are youth that are very ill and very problematic, and we're not only serving them, we're helping the parents hopefully become better able to manage the situation. We have things we do nowadays which are really helpful to stabilize families. So our belief is that it would serve a number of them. I mean, we do, I don't have exactly how many with the adult ones, but on the innovation side, this is, you know, you can have four at any one time, every day. It could be a different four. So every day there could be four that you're dealing with to try to keep them from ever having to go into a hospital.
Okay.
And the cost of that is about 1.2 for 3 years.
Okay. Did I understand correctly you there would be a $4 million per year savings? Is that what you said?
No, what I'm saying is that based on our FSP outcomes, which are up there now, hospital savings were almost $3.4 million for a year in savings of hospitalizations that we averted. The incarceration costs you have up there has more to do with avoidance. I mean, they didn't go into jail, but other people might have. But that was a quality of life issue. So we're really focused on that second number there, where with adults we found that there was a tremendous amount of savings. And that was basically with our integrated forensic team, our homeless outreach team, and to some extent our older adult team.
You mentioned that hopefully it would be successful. If for some reason it isn't, how long period of time will it take to determine to come to that factor? That decision.
So which one are you talking about, the innovation or the FSP?
The innovation.
The innovation is for 3 years. At the end of all innovation projects end in 3 years. Sometimes there were some that were two. And it could be up to four. But this one is three. So it's the outcomes.
Is that determined locally or is that determined by the department?
No, it's determined by our department.
Okay.
And it is based on outcomes. If the outcomes are not forthcoming, then that's the end of that. Okay. We're not going to continue.
So we're looking at a three-year period,
The innovation, a three-year period.
Now how about the other?
The FSPs, basically, you know, again, we would want to see if they didn't work, why would we continue to fund that? Mm-hmm. There aren't the same restrictions yet because it's not a time-limited project. An FSP is an ongoing. But it just seems like for the number of youth that are getting hospitalized for which we do not have a remedy right now, these two programs are hopefully going to intervene in an effective way with that so we can reduce our hospitalizations.
Well, I accept that, but for the, let's say, hopefully I'm not correct, but it isn't working. How long do you before you make that determination on the second issue then?
On the FSP? You know, I think what we would try to do is modify it to begin with and see if that would help. Okay. If it is not having the same kinds of outcomes that we're having for our adult FSPs, then we would have to go back to the stakeholders and look at not continuing that.
We have to have approval of this in order to go on, correct?
In order to implement
now,
it, yes.
Where do they come in to determine about the success or how?
Yeah, you know, when I come to present on the annual update, we always look at the past year, which is where that came from. Right. So you have an opportunity then to look, because it will be separated out. This was the consolidated that you have up there. But each one of those FSPs had their own savings outlined. So you will see the FSP for children. It will not be a year by then. By the time we go through the RFP process, the whole thing, I doubt we'll be getting going hardly at all by the time we have to look at it. But in the following year, you will see the outcomes, and you can then make your comments about whether you think that is working or not.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
And so, Madeline, just one last question. So are we really looking at saving $974 or almost $1,000 a day to the extent we keep these kids out of the acute psych?
Yes.
And so we'll definitely be able to quantify this and tell if this thing is working.
Yes. And, again, it's much more than the dollars. I just can't imagine how traumatic it is. So,
right.
You know, that in itself is also a major factor. But, yes, dollars, you will see dollars saved by the hospitalizations that were averted, because we know when they come in to be assessed to be admitted. and we keep track of that. And right now, we're diverting 51% of them, but still, 50% of, I think we had 800 assessments this past year. That meant 400 still went in, $1,000, you know, that's, and sometimes that's per day, so it could have been adding up for all the kids that were in.
Right. And that's not to mention, like I say, not just the dollars here, but then whatever, 5-10 years down the road, where these kids are and how they've evolved, and maybe because we were able to treat them early.
That is the prevention aspect to this, is that we may be able to intervene early enough that we are able to get them on a different track so that they don't end up in the criminal justice system. They don't end up on the in the child welfare system. They don't end up homeless, wandering around on our streets. So there's, you know, there are advantages that are not as necessarily as easily quantifiable.
Right. Okay.
Okay, so just going forward here, go to, again, the, keep going forward. I think we've kind of ended, keep going to the housing. Okay. All right. So, we also have another CSS project we're proposing, which is to create or employment opportunities for individuals with lived experience. And so I am going to ask my Chief of Consumer and Family Affairs to come up and just give a very brief report on this aspect of our proposal. I'd like to introduce Pam Esparza.
Morning. Good morning, Board of Supervisors, Mr. Risen and Mr. Doring. Today I'm presenting on the employment, supportive employment expansion opportunities. And part of MHSA core values is hiring persons with lived experience and their ability to engage through this, through the connections and the experience that they have had. Really gives us the understanding and compassion that, you know, working with those with mental health challenges. This is going to be 12 part-time positions. It's really about mentorship and hands-on training for individuals coming into the field. We have a job coach that will be supporting these individuals. It really is a, you know, a prevention piece. It's a stigma reduction, some of the board priorities that you guys have mentioned. It's really mainstreaming into society for individuals, becoming independent, maybe not on the system. So that's the focus of this. It's, you know, typically individuals who have never been able to work or have been out of work due to their disability, and we're engaging them back into the workforce through this.
Okay, any questions of Pam, maybe?
She's going to stay up here, but if you have questions on that, please.
Well, we have the alliance that does some of this work already. Are we duplicating what we've already got?
Typically, the alliance doesn't deal with supported employment. They do connect people to getting jobs, but working with persons with disabilities, usually they will direct them to go to the state Department of Rehabilitation, and we partner with the state of rehabilitation.
Right. I think the supportive, the word supportive is really the important word here, and that these are part-time. So it's not expected that they would stay in these. We're using a classification, clerical community aid classification that the county has. But I really do think that the whole point of this is the mentoring, the coaching people with disabilities to get them so that they can then have work experience, paid work experience, which, you know, a number of them will volunteer with us, but they don't. You know, paid work experience, I think, is a really different issue, and we really want them to get into the workforce.
And that would be 12? Is that your number?
Yes. With this number, it's 12.
At any one time.
Is there any period of time per person involved? In other words, how long is that period of training?
So this is, you know, for a year. This is a three-year total funding as well, so it's about $129,000.
So the training, one person could have 3 years training, 1 year training, two-year training?
We would probably do a year at a time for an individual.
Okay, so then there'd be an evaluation? at that time.
Absolutely. And the idea is once they get that year's paid mentoring and training, that they can move up into an entry-level position within the county.
Within what? The county, you said?
Yes. They would qualify for some of our entry-level positions within BHRS as a clinical service technician.
Okay, thank you.
And they may be also getting into our administrative clerks. I mean, there's other opportunities that they might actually qualify for, and then they have some work experience and some job evaluation that is more helpful, I think, when you're trying to get a job, if you've got some of that to show.
And again, these are going to be individuals with work experience who can then, you know, work better with the individuals that we serve.
Okay. But then it'd be the evaluation of the need and the qualification of the individual, so that it depends upon the circumstances at the time, correct?
At the time, yes.
Okay.
And what is the cost of this? Because there's no cost associated with any of this.
Next slide. That's the cost for 3 years. And it is in the agenda item, I think, that we have broken out costs, but also in the plan update itself, it's clearer, each one. But for the CSS proposed funding, we have the FSP, and we have this, and we have the... those. So for the FSP, it was the 2.1 and the 3, and this 387.
So is the objective here to get these people employed in the private sector, or to get them employed with behavioral health services? I mean, that seems
actually,
like
I don't think that we're making. I think they're gonna work well in our system, but it doesn't mean that they would have to get employment in our system. They could, you know, with some of the skills they're gonna have, they may be able to work for some of our contractors. Or if they do get in as a clerical person, then that is open to other private individuals as well.
Yeah, most individuals we work with in the employment program, when they are ready to go to work, you know, they want a job. So it could be private, it could be the public sector, you know, depending where what their interests are and what they qualify for.
This is some of the most questionable stuff you've ever heard. Organizations like Alliance are concentrating on getting people to work in the private sector and not into the government. It just seems like it's a big pot of money you've got, and you're just spending it on just very questionable things.
Well, I guess the difference again here is that these individuals may never have worked. They may need to have support in a different way than just going to work for somebody without that. So considering that they come in with mental health challenges and we're working with them to get them to be ready to work in, it could be in the private sector. I mean, we're not saying it's only with us. We do have entry-level positions that they would qualify for. But I also know that there are contractors and there would be private opportunities as well, because we are sharpening their employment skills. So in my mind, it's kind of like these individuals now may be on the public. They're receiving disability benefits. What we're helping them do is become independent and work and be a contributing member of our society. So instead of living on as a disabled individual, we have an opportunity here to help them be employed, not necessarily with us. It could be with us, but it's not exclusively with us, because they'll have job skills. We have technical pieces as well that they could get into. So I don't know that, I understand your point that it seems duplicative, but what we're actually doing here is mentoring and job coaching, which is very specific to people with disabilities that we're working with now, and getting them off Social Security getting them on to earning a living and making and contributing and paying taxes and all the things that we all do. So that's, I think, the only thing I think that it, this is a really valuable piece that we do not have right now.
Well, I don't know. It's just, yeah, I would support all that and getting people into the workforce and all that, but I always think of the private sector. It just seems like, you know, you're doing this to just slide them into a government job that really doesn't exist.
Well,
you know, Myra, let me just jump in for a second, if I could, Jim, because I appreciate what you're saying. I understand your concerns. We had our last meeting at Josie's Place, which is out here on 9th Street, and it is full of people who have experienced what the people are that they're treating. It's that shared experience, and it's just unbelievable how valuable that is to have, rather than people like us, our staff, in there mentoring these people or trying to counsel them, to have somebody who's actually lived, you know, 3 years out on the street and had all these issues, and they can sit there and relate so well with these people. And so I see this as twofold. First, we're getting people in there and they're going to get a job. They're going to get trained, and which probably takes them off the street, first of all, and keeps them out of our system for hopefully a long time. And then they're there with that experience, and there's nothing more valuable. You know, I just sit in there, and I see this as these people come in, and they can talk with someone besides some old white guy like me sitting there. They can see someone who's been out there and lived with them on the streets and been through this before and successfully got out of that. And it just, and the multiplier effect of this is I just think is invaluable. And so I know it's hard to see when we're talking about this, geez, how's this going to pay off? But I really think the dividends that this pays, you know, we're getting people out the street, we're training them so that now they're going to move forward, and then they're going to be there to bring that next, you know, the next ones that come in to help them. So until you really get out there and sit in, like you said, go sit at Josie's Place one day and watch what goes on in a day there, and see the people who are working there who at one point were out on the streets, but now they're working there. So now from an accountant standpoint, it makes sense, very much so, besides from the human side of it. The account, it does pay off for itself.
I do have to say, you know, this is part of recovery, that you recover and you're a functioning individual in our society, independent of the public expense. So thank you for those comments. Any other questions on this, please? Okay. Hopefully, okay, the next piece is our approval for a supportive housing project. Again, the funding for this was part of the original allocation with MHSA. A certain amount went to CalHFA. To be held for us to use to develop housing resources in our community. And we already have one recently, which is the Bennett Place, 18 units that we use. So I'm going to let Pam also talk about this particular piece of the project. And this is just to authorize us to have CalHFA contribute the money to this project.
Hello. Okay, again, this is in line with the board priorities in dealing with homelessness and prevention. We could definitely use more affordable housing for very low-income individuals here in Stanislaus County. And this is the one-time funding of MHSA that you can only use. It's categorical. You can only use it for construction, acquisition, and rehabilitation. And so for development, which is very far removed from mental health, it's multi-funding layers of funding. And so this is a partnership with STANCO, an affordable housing agency here in town, NAMI, the City of Modesto, and CTR. We are going to build 4 one-bedroom units, and these are to meet the needs of individuals who meet the MHSA criteria. It's going to have a community resource center on site. NAMI does a lot of family education classes and trainings out in the community. They'll probably do AA, NA type meetings there, other meetings for community. That's really all I have on this, unless you have any questions.
Bill?
We building ground up?
No, the community center is an existing two-bedroom home. It sits on a large piece of land, and so in the back part of it, it's going to be ground up. It's building the four one-bedroom units, and then they're going to rehab and expand that house to have a community room. And the offices are going to be for the NAMI.
Okay. And is the $490 the entire cost of the project, or that's just...
No, that's just the MHSA portion.
It's entire,
yes.
What's the entire...
Development cost? Is many, many hundreds of thousands of dollars. So there's home funds that are being... Stanco put in for an RFQ through the City of Modesto for home funds and CHOTO funds, and they received that.
Okay, so...
I don't off the top of my head. I want to say it's close to $600,000 that they received from the City of Modesto.
Okay.
Yeah, the property is being donated by CTR. It's about $230,000 they paid for the property, the piece of property. They're going to deed it over to Stanco to develop and then maintain it.
Okay. Any other questions of Pam? Okay.
That would take care of how many people in that project? You say four homes, one bedroom, but what are the other costs are for what now, other than the four homes?
So you can house more than one person in these if it was a family. I'm sorry. There could be several people living in one of these units, but there are four units for individuals to live in. So
it could be total, say, of eight people?
Yeah, it could be.
Maximum problem.
Or it could be a single, yeah. So they do have...
In addition to the other monies you were talking about, those monies are for what now?
It's for development.
Development of what?
Development of this house.
Of the house?
Yeah, the housing project.
Well, it's actually, what it is the remodeling of the house that's currently there on the property.
You're talking about like $600,000 perhaps in addition to this.
Well, again, there's other funds. This is just our funding for a project that will include remodeling of the house itself to become the community center, plus on the back part of the lot, developing four one-bedroom units. So it is...
The center would consist of what? What are you talking about?
Well, again, it's going to have a large group room. It's going to have an area that they can... I know they do cooking classes sometimes. NAMI does, correct? So
that would be the facilities would be used for additionally other than the eight people or other people?
Yes, yes. It's for the community. It's a community resource.
How large a number do you think you can accommodate in the community center of that?
In that room, probably 30 to 40 people altogether.
Thank you.
Okay, so any other... All right, so moving on here, the last little piece is to add a little bit more money to our allocation to the statewide CalMESA. They would like to have 4% of our PEI allocation for statewide projects, which are the suicide prevention, stigma reduction, and the Student Mental Health Initiative. So this would just add $30,000 to bring our total up to $120,000. This is a one-time expense. We don't know what we'll show next year. PEI has not a lot of extra money in it, so this may be the last contribution that we're able to make. So the recommendations would be to adopt the fiscal year 2015-2016 Mental Health Services Act plan update, to authorize the behavioral health director to sign and submit the plan update for fiscal year 2015-2016 to the Mental Health Services Oversight and Accountability Commission, to authorize the General Service Agency Purchasing Division to issue RFPs on behalf of our department for services discussed in this agenda item, and authorize the Auditor Controller to adjust the fiscal year 2015-2016 appropriations and estimated revenue as detailed in the budget journal. So with that, if there are additional clarifications and questions, I'm happy to answer them.
You know, Matt, I'm going to let Stan kind of summarize this a little bit.
First of all, let me say thank you, Madeline, for your presentation. As I look at the agenda item, I think we probably could have done a better job laying out some of the costs and maybe explaining per program so that you could see that a little bit clearer. So I'd like to kind of summarize a couple things because it's been kind of a conversation all over the place today, and I just want to share a couple things. First, when it comes to the full-service partnership, I just want to be clear that we're not going to be going after any local hospital beds. What we're trying to do is provide an intensive level of case management that we can avert these kids from ending up in the system to begin with, and that it's very costly when we do have to send them because we have to pay for the ambulance to take them out of county. And it sounds like we're averaging anywhere from 4 to 12 a day. And Shannon, did you say it costs us $600,000 a bed a year? Did I hear that somewhere? Okay, well, forget that part. But
it's around $1,000 a day per person.
Okay, $1,000 a day per person. The budget here is $2,012,000 over 3 years. You anticipate having some savings from the hospital diversion. Where would that savings occur budget-wise?
Well, the savings would, again, we may not use all the MHSA money. The savings now, the hospital beds are paid out of a separate account, not MHSA.
Okay.
So we receive funds out of the behavioral health subaccount and also the 1991 realignment. So the savings would be coming out, going into those two accounts.
So when you report back to the board, you'll clearly be able to track the cost avoidance based on historical averages from our investment in the full service partnership.
Correct.
Intensive case management.
Yes.
And then modeling what we've done on the adult side, the idea is to create a four-chair crisis intervention program that's been very successful on the adult side. And what were the costs associated with that, Madeline?
The costs associated with that were about $400,000 a year. And again, you can serve four kids at one time, but again, that's every day. So it would be up to four every day. So in those prime times when we are, again, sometimes we are always able to flex staff as well. Again, it will be a contractor, and we would expect they might be able to do the same thing. So if there's no one there, the staffing is not going to be the same. So again, like we do with our own SIP. Right. So $400,000, hopefully we're diverting more kids and the costs of that.
And then we go on to the employment program, and I'd like to point out that this is providing, even though we have the Alliance WorkNet that specializes in a lot of these activities, this is supplying a level of intensive, almost case management, again, with these folks that the Alliance would not typically have the resources to come up and provide that level of individual care to help mainstream these folks back into employability. So I think that's what's unique here is the amount of attention and training that they're receiving, which would be above and beyond what a normal client would receive. And then the housing piece, I think I heard that the total project, if I was putting pieces together, is probably over $1 million. There's a great emphasis on what's called housing first that says as we put people into more permanent housing, our ability to keep them out of all the costs of the other system, being in the system, whether it's the emergency rooms or whatever. They say I've heard numbers anywhere from $29,000 to $58,000 a year a chronic homeless person costs a community. And the idea is that with housing first, by putting them into more permanent housing, you're able to reduce your overall impact on the system.
It has its pros and cons.
It does have its pros and cons.
Still out for evaluation.
Yeah. And then the last piece is just a contribution to your this particular organization, correct?
To the JPA, which is we're a member of.
Okay. So my attempt to summarize it better.
Very good. Okay. Vito, go ahead.
Stan had asked the question, but I'm not sure I heard the final answer. If we have cost avoidance, we spend $2 million and we have cost avoidance, it comes out, money is saved in another pot. So we spend $2 million and we avoid $1 million in cost. So that money is still sitting in that fund. What is that money available to be used for, the cost avoidance money? Because it sounded like it was to pay for beds.
Well, again, it's in the behavioral health subaccount and in the 1991 realignment accounts. So we're never, you know, flush with money in those accounts. I think that our SIP has done a lot to offset the adult population and going into the hospital. So we have a fixed amount of money, and as you might recall, we are often in a deficit situation with our managed care, which is paying for the hospital beds. So savings in that allows us to be able to come in under the allocations that we get for the managed care, which is the beds, and also keeping people out of state hospitals and IMDs, which we pay for out of the 1991 realignment. So intervening early, we know, unfortunately, that when youth grow up and we haven't really dealt with the problems effectively, they can end up in IMDs. They can end up in the state hospital. Very costly alternatives.
But is that money available to be used for more services, expanding services? If we take out $2 million over here and we spend $2 million over here, but we, you know, and then we have cost avoidance, we want to be able to spend all of the money.
Well, again, if we're running a deficit situation in managed care and we only are able to survive because we have a fund balance at times, we're having to use that fund balance, which we could use for other services.
Okay.
This helps us true up that a little bit so that we have more flexibility with what we might use our fund balance on.
Okay. And then the last one on the housing. So we have... We can bring 30 or 40 people in. We can do drug and alcohol anonymous cases. Who's staffing that, and how are we paying for the ongoing operation?
NAMI is running most of the stuff there, as I understand it. The National Alliance for Men, our local chapter, would have a place to run a lot of their groups. Right now, they often rely on us to find that space, so that would be a space that would be theirs, that they could run these provider groups. They do a lot of education peer-to-peer. Our staffing, as I understand it, the housing piece is just the money to develop that. We have people now who work. We have a housing unit. They would probably be involved with the units and getting them filled. But the community center is going to be where NAMI is a community center.
Okay. Supervisor O'Brien.
Yeah. I want to thank you and your staff for all the hard work going into this plan. Mental health is a serious and prevalent issue in this community. It affects more people than we realize or we know. And it takes a lot of work to see reductions. Many of these initiatives probably have a lot of good merit. I'm just not convinced today that it's the best use of our funds. And let me explain that. We talked a lot about funds today, and you're absolutely right. It's not just about the money. It's about getting people to a place where they function better in society. But that's kind of our role in Board of Supervisors. Board of Supervisors is to say, you know, we have a limited amount of money. We can't fix all the mental health issues in our community. It's just too much of a price tag that we could do. And so we have to realize in what's the best bang for our buck. When I talk to general public out there, homelessness is becoming such a prevalent issue. It seems like homeless are getting more aggressive in our community. And as we all know, mental health issues are a huge aspect of being homeless. And there's little traces of prevention here, but when we look at a housing unit that has four units. We need so much more than that. How can we parlay this into more units? How can we parlay the job training into more than 12 people? We need to see what we can do to make it bigger and better. And that's why I say it has merit. It's just I'm not there yet. I'm not convinced that this is the best bang for our buck. I don't know where our suicide rates are this year. I know last year we had a 30% increase.
Right, and it has gone down.
Okay. I haven't seen any numbers, so I'm sure it's still pretty big.
Okay.
And so our commitment is to be at the minimum level. You know what? Either we're going to take a stand against suicide or we're not, but to be at the minimum level, let's pull back all $120,000 of that and do our own suicide prevention program rather than let the state of California flounder around with it, because
Not the state of California. It's the JPA. It's the Organization of Counties. The money's going to these statewide projects, meaning that they cover the entire state. What the advantage of that has been is that they have also funded suicide prevention hotlines. We are working with one of them. We expect that in the future we're going to have to take over more of the contribution to that. They have developed all the materials for the stigma reduction and the signs on the freeway and everything, and both for suicide prevention and stigma reduction. The school mental health initiative, our county has benefited from both at the K-12 level, the junior college level, and the CSU level. So it's not going back to the state. It's basically it's from the counties for statewide issues that we couldn't afford ourselves. And like I said, I think that that isn't necessarily going to be a cost going. I mean, it's not an expense going forward if that is not your intention for us to do that. They are looking right now for other funding, not depending on counties. They want to continue to look for other kinds of funding rather than just rely on counties, because that isn't going to be workable going forward.
Okay. All right.
But I, you know, again, it's 12, back to the employment, just to say it's 12 for 3 years, so it's 36 people ultimately that we would hope to be gainfully employed.
And just a guess, how many people do you think need those services in our community, in our county? Probably 3,600.
Well, you know, of those that are disabled and receiving disability for their mental illness, that's probably less than that. But because I think we're thinking maybe in the county there's maybe 35,000 people that are severely mentally ill. Again, not all of those are going to be able to become employed.
Absolutely.
But, yeah, the need is there.
We don't have enough money to address all the needs. I guess that's what my point is.
Yeah.
And so is this the best bang for our buck?
Okay. Supervisor Chiesa.
Well, we're tasked with how to spend money. And as we've gone through this horrific economy, now it's how to rebuild the organization. And what are our priorities? And obviously mental health, as Supervisor O'Brien talked about, is one of our priorities. And we've had this discussion whether we do it longitudinally, we hire more folks, and in what departments. You see we're doing that in public safety. But what I've seen so far, especially in mental health, that it's rebounded a little quicker. The state has realized and the board has realized that this is an epidemic that's costing us more money. And through the cost avoidance, through our PUF, putting up our PUF facility, and now we're going to have the crisis stabilization unit up by, I think, around January.
Yeah, February.
And so that is our goal going forward. When I look at how we came to these decisions, how you came to the decisions, the stakeholder process, I think it's been a fair stakeholder process. The idea bank going to the steering committee and utilizing the board priorities. When we talk about individual programs, I think you see there's a lot of concern in individual programs. I'm not sure if that's born out of our beliefs or if we don't think it's going to save the money or if we think it costs too much, like in the construction of the houses. I can tell you that board briefing should have been a must here. I think that's very apparent right now. because there's a lot of confusion. I think there's some confusion going forward. I see how successful we've been with the adults and talking about the wraparound services, trying to keep people from getting into a psychotic episode or an acute episode. And I think we've proven that we've been successful. And so the obvious step for me would be for the children. I think that that's okay. I still share some of the concerns on the housing. It seems to me that building housing from the ground up, that we could find a group-type setting that have individual rooms, seems like it would be cheaper. I know there might be a reason why you can't do that.
No, we do that. We do have that. This money can only be used for acquisition, rehabilitation, or development. So that's the strings on this. So if you don't use it for this, what other project is going to come along that we have to use it for?
Yeah, and coming back to new construction versus rehabbing, we look at the drug and alcohol beds we have out at Ceres, and you would think that it would be cheaper for us to find something and rehab it, more bang for our buck. Again, I'm not here to tell you that it is the cheapest way, because you see this confusion that's been created today, which probably isn't good, but I agree that the money needs to be spent and that we will provide a better service and we will avoid costs. I have no doubt in my mind out-of-county placements must be just horrific for the families. So I want to be supportive of this today. I do want to be supportive of it. I just share the same concerns. I think you'll hear some of the same concerns. But because you know this went through the stakeholder process, I probably will support it. But just know that that the best bang for our buck, always remember we're in charge of someone else's money. It's the people's money, not just our money. And just because we have it to spend on new construction doesn't mean we have to spend it on new construction. So.
Martini.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I certainly have a lot of reservations about this, and I just think it's questionable projects, duplication of effort. The building these new units doesn't. I'm not sure that we really need to be doing that. And probably you should have come and briefed us on this instead of throwing
something out
like that. I'm not going to support this today because I just have too many questions about it. I just do not believe we're getting any bang for the buck or the need is really there. The board is, you have the board priorities and they're listed in here, and I'm not sure this actually accomplishes what we're trying to do here. You ought to maybe just go back and rework this thing to something be more acceptable, instead of just giving us something like this and expect us to rubber stamp it like you're doing. the numbers that you're talking about are so small, and I just have to question everything about this. I was not expecting something like this to come to us with so little said about it, actually nothing really. So my thought would be to go back and rework it and work with us a little bit. I'm not going to vote for this today.
Okay. Any other comments? Just my two cents here, and maybe this is a little, because I sit on the mental health board and I feel probably pretty strongly about this, is that this really is not a leap of faith here. You know, more than anything, I think our through BHRS and Mental Health Service Act, we have this results-based accountability. And I guess I'm very proud of the way the mental health has provided services and then shown us if those services are producing results or not. And they've been able to quantify that. And again, I know I'm always talking about the numbers and the human side, but it is so important. But when we're just talking about numbers, which is what we're up here, and I understand everybody's concerns here, because there is a lot of confusion, obviously, here today on this agenda item, but from what I see, and again, I probably have an insight that others don't, because I sit on that. we at the mental health through BHRS, we are accountable to what we're doing, to the programs we're doing, and actually have kind of led, I feel, to some extent, the county, a lot of other departments too, with this accountability, this results-based accountability. And it actually has flowed into our focus on prevention.
Right.
You know, it's gone right into that, and that's where kind of we came from. We had a meeting Friday. Was it Friday? Yeah, we had a Friday with the Mental Health Service Oversight Committee that came and toured our county. And then we were able to sit down, myself and Stan, and talk a little bit about focus on prevention at that meeting with these people from the state. And we are leading, I think, in the state with what we're doing here. And again, not to try to minimize the concerns up here, because there's definitely concerns, and that is our job, to make sure that the dollar amounts are there. I just feel like I have a little bit better feeling for this whole thing, because I know that if what we're doing here, if these funds that we're asking for here today aren't productive, it will stop just based on what we've done in the past. And so I'm sorry for the confusions and stuff up here today, but I think kind of as Supervisor Chiesa said, we've done well at the adult level. We've got to get down to the youth level. You know, I'm thrilled that we're doing this, and time will tell if this is money well spent or not. And if it's not, like we do constantly throughout this county, we will correct our course and move into another direction. But it's but I think we're definitely focusing on the right areas. The programs that we're proposing here are towards areas that we have got to get to, and who's to say if they're going to work, but we will know if they're going to work here soon, and come back and adjust our course if we need to. So any other comments? Supervisor Monteith.
I don't think anyone on this board is objecting to addressing the mental health issue. In listening to the various questions that have been asked, I'm merely going to throw out this. It might be advantageous, rather than making that decision today, is come back with a little more explanation to resolve it so the question can be answered. I think we probably didn't anticipate the magnitude of this, and I merely bring that up if that one to be taken under consideration.
Okay. That's a suggestion. Is that a direction that we could go, guys? Maybe come back here quickly? How much time do we have to?
Well, you know how it is. Something you approved last September is just now being implemented. The only problem, I have no problem if that is the decision. I will make it work. The money reverts. This is one of those funds that you don't keep. So if we don't use and we do the best we can with first dollar in, first dollar out, trying to make sure nothing is there, because we have 3 years to spend our allocation. And so we really monitor that. But after it gets to a point, you start to see that there could be a point at which we're going to end up sending money back to the state, which to me would be far worse.
So I wonder if we could, rest of this week, it sounds like briefings is what we really need, just to sit down with you, Madeline. I wonder if we could, by the end of this week, Madeline, you could get together with everybody and we could go through this and get this back on the agenda quickly.
Yeah, no meeting next week.
So. But there are a couple of meetings in September, so I can definitely agree to do that. I very much apologize not having done it.
Okay.
That would be my recommendation. We want to make sure that you have all the information you need from which to make an informed decision. And, I feel like, it's on me that I didn't make sure that there was enough in this agenda item to get you there. And I think board briefings would be valuable. So that would be my request, is that you allow us to bring this back for consideration.
Absolutely.
At a later meeting in September.
Okay.
Let me look at my calendar real quick, and I'm going to actually request September 29th, if that's not too late for you.
No.
Just to make sure that we have adequate time to really vet this.
Okay. Everybody okay with that? So do we need a motion to move this to the 29th?
I'll second that.
We have a second? To continue this to the 29th. We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Passes 5-0. Thank you, Madeline. We'll see you back here. Thank you. Okay. We are going to move on now.
Let them work this over.
To item B8 that we have just stuck in here today.
Nobody wants to speak.
No, okay. How are you, Patty?
I'm just slow.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, Mr. Risen, Mr. Doering, and to our audience. Your board has already acted this morning to approve adding what we now call item B8 to the agenda, and that is approval to declare an emergency in accordance with the Public Contract Code, sections 20.134 and 22.050. To contract for emergency repairs at our County Center 3 location at Scenic Drive in Modesto. This will be to repair the electrical power supply and replace an emergency generator and other equipment to restore essential county operations. I think that there's no greater time when you need people committed to solutions than when there's an emergency or a problem. And very early on Friday morning, and I'm not going to give you all the details, and there are a lot of experts in this room that can help me to answer technical questions you may have. There were indications that there was a problem with our systems at the Health Services Agency. That problem evolved with tremendous immediate response by the county's General Services Facility Maintenance Division, who have barely been home since that Friday morning time period, and who are in the audience today, and the Modesto Irrigation District, who has proven to be a very reliable power source for that part of Modesto where that County Center 2 facilities are located. And essentially, the long version boils down to this. There was a significant power outage. And that power outage was caused by the failure of equipment and resulted in the failure of more equipment. And the essential county operations, one of the conditions you must consider this morning to declare an emergency, really get to critical programs provided by our health services agency, including patient care, by our behavioral health and recovery services, particularly their crisis lines, other services, systems, phones, and equipment, and ultimately its failure. This failure is about equipment, but it's really about confidence in our service level provision, whether it's elevators or telephone systems, and the failure of the central plant's backup power. Now, I know the board is aware, and I'll make sure the public is aware, that the County Center 3-2 location there on Scenic Drive is an old facility. It has a central plant. Today, we would love to have central plants at the new facilities that we build, but they're not always economically feasible. This central plant has been cared for very diligently by the county's maintenance staff over the years. It essentially powers and provides continuous power to things that make those facilities and programs work. And the best example that I heard right in the midst of this emergency developing is the elevators. And your board has approved an upgrade in the elevators in the old hospital building that's used for patient care, administration, and a variety of programs there. And what that system off the generator, the central plant, does, and this is about as technical as I'm going to get with you myself, is it ensures that if there's a power surge or a power bleep or whatever, that there's a feed almost instantaneously, 5 seconds, it's been described to me, that keeps that elevator going, that keeps those systems where the patients are calling in, that keeps the records going, it keeps the crisis and suicide hotline phone lines going. And that's what failed. That failure resulted in the emergency generator and something called an automatic transferring switch being fried. Described to me, I've seen the photo, some photographs, as melting together. And how thankful we are that the security firm that provides security at County Center 2, in the early morning, a young man smelled something. Again, I think the true test of when we're needed and when our team is needed is when something goes wrong. That event, starting early Friday morning and continuing well into yesterday, has a significant consequence if we don't step in immediately and make the needed repairs. So there is power today at the site, and most systems have been restored. There is some residual damage to some of the server backup power systems, and the individuals responsible for that are in this room if you have questions about that as well. But the reality is that we are dependent on that location for critical county services, particularly focused on patient care. And the standards that the public contract code require your board to look at about the continuous operation of essential services, in our view, has been absolutely and fully met. What we're asking you to do today is to declare an emergency in accordance with the public contracts code. And this is why the public contracts code is there. And I have told you this before, and I'll tell you today, just because we ask you to approve an emergency, and if you choose to declare it, doesn't mean we won't be diligent about how much we spend and how we get this work done. It means that we can move like we were in the private sector and make a good business decision and get back to work. And that's what this public contracts code allows for. Your action today needs to be by a 4/5 vote of your board. You need to find that the damages occurred at County Center 2 as a result of the failure of the automatic transfer switch and then the emergency generator on August the 28th did occur, that the repair is necessary to permit the continued conduct of essential county operations, and declare that the emergency would avoid any delays that would result from making these repairs. You would need to acknowledge and ratify the immediate repair decisions already made to mitigate the situation, direct the chief operations officer working with the team as the project manager, and pursuant to the public contract code, authorize us to take any and all actions necessary and appropriate to repair and replace the electrical and other systems, and finally to require us to report back to you fully on the status of this every 14 days before the Board of Supervisors. The emergency generator has been damaged beyond repair. It needs to be replaced. Today, power has been restored. There is no backup power at the site. That's the essence of the declaration of emergency we seek. Our team has done a great job. I'm going to tell you who they are because they need to go home and get some rest, I think, shortly. But there is a small generator at the public works yard that can be moved in to provide some minimal backup power during the likely 10 to 12 week period where this repair and replacement will occur. And that's the best guess of what it will take by the declaration of the emergency and working directly with our local contractor. There are some systems damage that has occurred and can be repaired as all. We are working directly with a general contractor. I thought I brought that with me. Industrial Electric in Modesto, California. We will have a couple more scoping sessions with your approval, if you approve proceeding today, to be sure that the solution makes good business sense as well. That is, we won't be on that site forever for all of the health services agency functions. And we want ability to be portable in some way with this investment to follow us where we go in the future. And that's very important to us. I just want to tell you, if you will not yet kick me out, that I think we all should be so grateful for the county team. They drop everything, We have 10 p.m. conference calls on Friday night and 10 a.m. conference calls on Saturday, and people on Saturday night and Sunday, and that's what our team is like in this county. You should be proud of that. I hope you are. You lead that spirit of cooperation and collaboration to our whole organization. And this is a time where, I'll tell you what, it couldn't be the CEO's office that could fix this. This is definitely a really challenging situation. I want to tell you about Chris Brooks, Matt Innes, and Caleb Cox. I'm not sure Caleb's in the room, but Chris and Matt are right back there. And they have a great sense of humor, and they know how to get things fixed. And we're grateful for their continuous effort all the way through being in the boardroom this morning. Randy Kavanaugh from our Capital Projects team just stepped up. He's a big thinker. To the whole GSA team, Keith Boggs, and here, guys, everybody didn't, it didn't matter that it was the weekend. It just mattered that we needed to get this fixed. The Health Services Agency really essentially had to set up a command center, BHRS as well. There were calls to critical service lines that couldn't work. Our SBT agency, Marsha and Sean in particular, Paul Gibson out of OES, lots and lots of details I'm not sharing with you today. And Cindy Tomlinson in the CEO's office pulled this all together. Joan Cox on the emergency side, and Jack as well. We're here to answer any questions that you may have. This is pretty simple. We have funds in the budget. We will seek reimbursement where possible, if there is a reimbursement for this source, but we seek your approval today to get this fixed.
Very good. Thanks, Patty. Any questions?
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman. So far, it looks like we've used local vendors when we needed to use local vendors, and I would just hope that as long as the local vendor is capable, that we utilize local.
Industrial Electric of Modesto, California is so reliable. They are integral to our delivery of maintenance and service to this facility, and we expect, and we have already received quotes and prices from them. We expect to proceed with them if your board acts this morning.
Very good. Thank you.
Very good. Any other comments? Very good. Thank you, Patty, and thank you guys for all you've done to get us through this here, and we appreciate all your effort above and beyond the call of duty here. So do we have a motion to approve the staff recommendations?
Motion to approve staff recommendations.
A motion. Do we have a second? We have a second. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Passes 5-0. Thanks, Patty.
Thank you. We'll be back to let you know our progress.
Very good. Thank you. Okay. We will move on to item C3. Mr. Salaberry, I'm sorry you've had to sit and wait this long, but just, well, your turn's almost here now. We appreciate your patience here.
All right.
Hey, Matt, how are you?
Good, good. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Supervisors, Mr. Eisen, Mr. Doring, Matt Machado, Director of Public Works. The item before you is a request to withdraw as a member of the Gomes Lake JPA with the intent to negotiate a new agreement that is equitable for all members. This agreement that's in place today was approved by this board in 2011, and it's been a very successful agreement. In 2011, we negotiated this agreement with a five-year term. This current fiscal year, 15-16, is our fifth year, so it's the last year of this agreement, the term of the agreement. But because the way the agreement was written, we must give notice, one-year notice, so that we can negotiate new terms. Now, I said successful because this agreement has developed or has provided capital reserves for this facility. This is a state-owned facility that's maintained by the local agencies and local landowners. And historically, this facility has had issues with capital failures, equipment failures, and there hasn't been capital reserves to deal with those. The five-year agreement that this board approved in 2011 established that as its primary goal, to develop capital reserves to put this system in good repair. We've done that successfully. At the end of this fiscal year, we'll have nearly $200,000 in capital reserve for the future. Additionally, in addition to that capital reserve, we were very successful with developing a security system out there. The system is fairly remote and has had a lot of vandalism over the past years. And so we as a JPA developed a plan and implemented that plan so that we could protect the facility. And so we spent, it was about $60,000 to protect the system. And in addition, we developed this capital reserve. So I would say this agreement has been very successful. We've had a good team working together, all the members of the JPA. But here we are, near the end of the five-year term. There is a need to negotiate new terms for this agreement. And the crux of it for the county is that currently in the agreement today, we're a 16% partner. Our share is 16% of the total cost. The true cost that we receive benefit by is more like 1-2%. And so I would say that this agreement was very generous in the past. Prior to that, we had even a larger share for really no known reasons. But this board was, I would say, generous with its goal of developing a capital reserve and approving a 16% share. But here we are at the end of the term, my recommendation is that we negotiate with the JPA members to get to more equitable terms down in that 1-2% range for Stanislaus County. And I would end on that, just to remind the board that this facility is owned by the state, and so if we can't come to terms with a new agreement and the JPA does dissolve, does go away, the state will step in. They do own it. They will take charge of it. They nearly did that in 2010 prior to the current agreement. And so there is a fail-safe plan here. If the members can't come to terms with a new agreement, the state will step in and provide direction. And so the recommendation today is to approve to withdraw as a member of the Gomes Lake Joint Powers Agreement effective July 1, 2016. We have just about 1 year to work through the terms of a new agreement, and so there's plenty of time, but we're here before you just to inform you and move forward. So with that, turn it to the board for any questions or comments.
Very good. Any questions from the board? Okay. We do have one public comment card here, Mr. Salaberry. We appreciate your patience. Come on up. It's a long meeting today. Thank you for...
Good morning, everyone. And I'm Joe Salaberry, and I'm with Reclamation 2063. And I'm the president of Reclamation 2063. Our share in the Gomez Lake, we got slapped 5 years ago when the county pulled from 35% to 16%. We got slapped with $11,000 that we have to come up every year from our share. We had enough expenses already. We were nearly broke, and yet we got slapped with $11,000 every year to pay for. What Mr. Machado then say, it's the county's got responsibility in this levy. You guys have 18 miles that were flooded in 1997. And the levy didn't even broke. Can you imagine what's going to happen if the levy breaks? How many miles you going to have flooded? And how much is it going to cost to the county to come up to fix those roads? Do you know that New Orleans, when they had a flood, the biggest expenses what they had was fixing their road. And Mr. Machado is going to tell me so that he's not going to have any problem with those roads if that road gets flooded. In 97, when it didn't even break the levee, my daughter's boyfriend was coming on Central with brand new Corvette. Hit a hole about 2 miles south of my place on Central Avenue, flip over, tore all the Corvette. He was going to sue the county. I don't know how I end up because my daughter broke up with him, so I don't know what happened with the results. Can you imagine how many lawsuits you guys going to have if the levy is not take care of it? And if you guys depends on those farmers to take care of the levy, you got a surprise. None of those farmers anymore cares about the levy. If they're going to have a loan, which they all do, most of them do. I don't, but most of them do. They gotta have $30,000 to $50,000 insurance, flood controls. They could care less if they lose their flood, lose their crops. They keep telling me, Joe, what the heck are you doing? We'd be better off if it floods. Let it flood. Is that what you guys want? Is that the way we operate in this county? It costs, you guys are only paying 16%, and now you guys telling me you guys going to pull out? I mean, what's $10,000 a year for the county when you got protection in the roots, when you got, I got the levee in 100% shape in 13 miles. Next Reclamation did a very good job. And I got the highest score for maintaining the levee last year. And now you guys are going to pull out of it? Is this a responsibility this county has? You don't have $10,000 to maintain the levee, and you're going to let it flow? Those farmers don't care. They tell me, just stay out of it. Let it break. And maybe we should let it break, if that's the way you guys want it. So are we this poor in this county so that we don't have $10,000? We already, like I said, we came up with $11,000. On top of my expenses now, we got slapped with $11,000 every year that we have to pay for the JPS, which we didn't have to pay before. And now some new county is going to come up. How much are we going to get slapped again higher? So my question to you guys is, I'm ready to give up. And if that's, you guys want the levy broken, let it broke. And then we'll find out how much you guys are going to have to come up with fixing the roads and fixing the losses you're going to have with all the damages. So it's up to you guys. You guys want to stay out of it? We'll see about it. I know the city of Tulloch wants to come out. They don't want to pay their share anymore either. And I told them, you guys have 55,000 gallons a minute. When you got a storm coming down in those pumps, and they don't want to take care of it, they're pretty much in the same spot as you guys are. They don't want notice. They don't want to pay for. But somebody's got to take care of that water at the other end. So maybe we'll let it go through the levee instead of we'll let it go through the pumps. Mr. Machado was just saying we got 200,000. Big deal. We could even buy a damn pump for 200,000. What the heck is 200,000 this? We got a project and I've been after TID and JPS. I want them to put a cement around so we can protect those pumps. We don't have no money. We don't have no money. I did it in my own pumps and we're saving thousands of dollars because I did it. And it's going to cost quite a few $100,000 to do it. It's a big deal we got $200,000. That's peanuts. And if we did a cement work up there, those pumps could last us to the last. We just spent about $40,000 to fix one pump. We got trash going through those pumps. And the way I did in my pumps, I put a cement around so those pumps were in the dry. When we're not using those pumps, they're completely in the dry. We can go up there, paint the inside and the outside. And we can go in there with a flashlight, check those pumps, how they are. And that's what I wanted to do in JPS. No, we don't have no money to do it. And now this. So it's up to you guys. If you want to drop us, we'll see. What I wanted to do is hire lawyers and go for it. I mean, sue you guys. That's what I wanted to do. And maybe we're going to end up by doing that. So maybe we'll spend some money with attorneys if there's another way to take care of this. So I let you guys decide it. Now you know what's going on. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Salaberry. Matt, any one comments there?
Well, you can see that a year of negotiation, we'll need every bit of that. Not going to be easy. I think the saving grace is that the facility is physically owned by the state of California, and the state of California will take it over. They nearly did in 2010. We'd like to keep the conversation factual, and we know the state will do that. And so if we fail in our negotiations, the state will step in, and they will make it right. And so I think the year is necessary. And I hope that you see the value in this. I think we've left this facility in great shape. We're not giving up on it. We're just trying to get to an equitable share. The roads do get protection, and that's the 1% to 2%. We want to stay a partner. We just want it to be equitable.
Sure, Mr. Salaberry, come on back.
Mr. Machado was saying, so that the state is going to take it over. Yes, they are. The Army Corps engineers will be coming out of Sacramento for 4-5 guys in the pickup. From the minute they left up there, the minute they get back, we're going to be paying those guys big time. And who's going to end up with the bill? You think the Army Corps engineer is going to be coming from Sacramento all the way coming here? And the way those guys work, I could see how good of a job they're going to do. I mean, every time when I got, for anything, you got 4-5 guys coming in one pickup. Instead of one pickup, you got 4 pickups up there coming with 15, 16 people. And I tell them, what's the crowd for? And yeah, it's overkill, Joe. Huh? Yeah, just a little bit overkill, yeah. And who's going to be paying for those guys coming? You think they're going to be coming free? No. We're going to have a huge bill somebody's going to end up by paying for. And who wants to be a farmer? That's going to happen in this county. That's getting pretty bad already without anything like this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Salvi. Supervisor Chiesa.
How much did we pay into, or how much were we paying in a year? Because we were building the reserve, right?
Right. Our share is about $10,000, a little bit over $10,000 a year.
Okay. And since, how did we end up with $200,000? Because there was hardly any money there.
So the annual budget that we all contribute into has a maximum of $63,000. And so 5 years, that's $300,000. But we did spend some on security measures. We spent about $60,000 on security measures. And this is maybe the benefit of the drought. We haven't had not much of a pumping cost. And so we've been able to accrue about $200,000 of savings.
And I was in on those meetings originally when we were trying to negotiate because it was in 2001, the new formula was 20% for Turlock Irrigation District, 35% for the city of Turlock, 45% for Stanislaus County, and that went until 2011. And the reclamation districts both paid zero. When the state of California was here, if we were to allow them to take it over, it essentially becomes a benefit assessment, right? He who benefits most pays the most. And we had that discussion. Can you recount any of that conversation?
Sure. So what the state would look at is they would look at an area of benefit, and whoever got the benefit would pay the bill. And it's fairly clear who gets the benefit. The low-lying lands get the benefit of this levee system, of this pumping facility. Well, the low-lying lands are the farmland, private lands. And so the state fairly easily said that, you know, the vast majority of the costs would go on to the farmers that are getting all the benefit. And Joe's right in the sense that, you know, the state, and it's not Army Corps, that's the federal government, but the state, DWR, would come in, and they probably would cost more than we locally would cost to do this analysis, but it's pretty clear that the people that get the benefit should pay the bill.
Okay. Supervisor DeMartini.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have a map of the reclamation districts in the back of our staff report. Do you have any idea just how many acres are involved in these shaded areas and what the...
And it's fairly clear who gets the benefit. The low-lying lands get the benefit of this levee system, of this pumping facility. Well, the low-lying lands are the farmland, private lands. And so the state fairly easily said that, you know, the vast majority of the costs would go on to the farmers that are getting all the benefit. And Joe's right in the sense that, you know, the state, and it's not Army Corps, that's the federal government, but the state, DWR, would come in, and they probably would cost more than we locally would cost to do this analysis, but it's pretty clear that the people that get the benefit should pay the bill.
Okay. Supervisor DeMartini.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have a map of the reclamation districts in the back of our staff report. Do you have any idea just how many acres are involved in these shaded areas and what the assessment per acre is? I don't see that in the report, although I do see a map. It looks like there must be several thousand acres.
About 20,000 acres for 18,000
And each district pays about the same percentage. They'd be paying about $11,000 a piece over 20,000 acres.
Well, that's only about a dollar an acre.
I don't think it's quite that much. I think it's less than that.
It seems like pretty reasonable. You can't do much with a dollar an acre anymore.
It's not more than a dollar an acre. We already raised our taxes twice.
Yeah. Mr. Salaberry, do you want to come up to the microphone maybe just so we can hear you better? Sorry.
It's over way over dollar an acre because we got expenses. It's not only we got to maintain the levee, we got to maintain the pumps, we got keep up the weeds, and there's a lot of expenses in that levee, and so just our budget, my budget, we get in about $70,000 a year, and we barely making it, and until about 3 years ago, $70,000, we were getting about $50,000, and we just didn't have enough money to make it. And then I came up with the idea of using tires instead of spraying the levee, and that's saving us about $40,000 a year. But what I do is I use truck tires, we pull them with the tractor real fast, and we tear those weeds. So I'm saving about $40,000 a year, which keeps us in the black, and that really helps. But there's a lot of expenses in the levee. You got a pump to maintain, and you got electric bills to pay, and we got contractors to do the work and keeping up with, because you got the DWR and Army Corps engineers. Seems like they're looking for a job. They just keep coming up with new things. You gotta do this. You gotta do that. I mean, it's unreal. And plus, they got so many people in there. They're just looking for a job, and they're just coming up with new things you can't even think. And it's getting ridiculous. But you gotta do it. And if you don't do it, they give you a bad rating, and you know you gotta do it.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I may, there's a bit of a mixture of ideas here, and so. Joe represents RD 2063, and we have a number of RDs, reclamation districts in the county, and they have their own levee systems that they maintain, they manage, they have their own pumps. The facility we're talking about today is the Gomes Lake pumping facility, and it really is just primarily a pump so that when the river is up high, a valve closes so that water can't free flow through the levee, and it has to be pumped over top of the levee. So the Gomes pumping facility is a large pump, it's a pond area, and it's a very small levee system. That is separate from what Joe's talking about in terms of their RD 2063 responsibilities. They have their own levee system. They have their own facilities that they maintain in addition to the Gomes Lake. Go back to Supervisor DeMartini's comment about how much per acre. Well, for the Gomes Lake facility, the RDs together pay about 30% of the bill. $63,000 budget, that's about $18,000 a year, is what they contribute to the Gomes Lake pumping facility. It's about 20,000 acres it covers, so it's a little less than a dollar an acre today for the RDs to contribute towards the Gomes Lake facility only. Gomes Lake facility is separate from their levee system, and so they have additional costs to manage their own levee system. The entire river has levees along its edge, and so there's a little bit of mixing of facilities here, but today we're just talking about the Gomes Lake pumping facility and a small levee system there. It is a little less than a dollar an acre is their share today.
Okay, very good. Any other comments, questions? Supervisor DeMartini?
No, I just have a comment. I have 3 miles of river frontage along the Tuolumne River, and I maintain that myself, and I don't expect the government to foot the bill for something that's 100% my benefit. So I just want to put that in. The government can't do everything for you. And paying a dollar an acre, or even a dollar and a half an acre, is nothing. Now, I maintain my levees. I don't even keep track of the cost, but I've had substantial costs in maintaining those over the years. But I get the benefit from it, so I maintain them.
Okay. Any other questions, comments? Just real quick, first of all, Mr. Salaberry, sorry you had to sit and wait so long for this to come up. But maybe to some extent there was a little bit good out of that, because you could see that our job up here is to be good stewards of the taxpayers' money, and you could see from that last presentation regarding mental health how important it is for us to make sure that we're spending the money, the taxpayers' money, correctly. And I think that's where this kind of comes into play to some extent. We've got we need to make sure it's for the benefit of the public that we're spending this money, not for the benefit of individual, you know, landowners necessarily. So so that's the position that we're in here, to try to fulfill our duties here. So
I'm 100% for saving taxes. Like I said, I saved the states already over $1 million for the project that I did 3 years ago by putting the rocks up there. I put a cement and they wanted to put the rocks, and I'd save over $1 million, and I save over another $745,000. The state wanted to spend $745,000 by Albert Mendez, that we had an inch and a half hole coming through the levee, and they wanted to spend $745,000 to fix that. And I told them, no, you're not, because it's called boil. And I told them, you're not going to do it, and they was going to do it. They already had the plans, drones, and everything, and they wanted the permission from the landowners, and I told them I was not going to let them do it. And they were going to start it, and I finally sent them a letter so that I was going to put $200,000, my own money, if the levee break in that spot. I still got the letter. I sent that to the Army Corps engineer, and I sent it to DWR. And I told them, I'm going to put $200,000 in escrow, my own money. If the levee break in that spot, you guys, that's your money. If it doesn't break, you guys owe me $100,000. Well, they called me back. I got Moreno from Army Corps Engineer. He called me up, Joe, you really mean in that letter what you're saying? I told him, it's in black and white. How do you want it? And he said, you really mean it? And I told him, how you want it? And he says, well, we're going to see about it. Well, they didn't build that. They didn't spend the $745,000. And that levy didn't break either. And I make a bet to anybody, $500,000, I bet him, so the levy is not going to break. And anytime you got a boil in one spot, next time you got to High River, it never happened in the same spot. So that's waste money. And right now, I had the city of Modesto, they wanted to join with us so that they got two boils. Each one is going to cost over $2 million. And I told them, you don't spend any money for boils. All you got to do is put some riprap in there. And that's all it takes. But the Army Corps engineer is willing to spend the $2 million for fixing a miserable boil. I mean, it's sick the way those guys can spend the money.
Well, thank you. We appreciate all you're doing, and we appreciate you being here today. And it sounds like, depending on what happens here, there should be a year to work this out.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Motion to approve staff recommendations.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
I'll second it.
A second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Passes 5-0. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
Okay. Moving on to correspondence.
This board has received a copy of the East Side Mosquito Abatements District's fiscal year 2015-16 annual budget.
Referred to the Auditor Controller.
This board has received two letters from the State Fish and Game Commission regarding proposed regulatory actions to transgenic definition, application, and fee regulations and relating to fish water sport fishing regulations, freshwater.
Refer to the Fish and Wildlife Committee.
And this board has received a letter from Sullivan Containers Manufacturing regarding the temporary layoffs at their facility located at 3250 Patterson Road in Riverbank, California, beginning on October 25, 2015, and employees are expected to be recalled in January 2016.
Refer to the Alliance WorkNet and the Stanislaus Economic Development and Workforce Alliance.
This board has received the claims as noted on the agenda.
Acknowledge receipt of claims and refer to the Chief Executive Office Risk Management Division. Any Board of Supervisor reports? None. Legislative updates.
Dan. No report this morning.
No report. We do have closed session.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we have closed session to have conference with legal counsel to discuss existing litigation pursuant to Government Code Section 54956.9, Subdivision D1. This involves one case, County of Stanislaus versus City of Modesto, Stanislaus County Superior Court, case number 667397. We do not expect a report out on this matter.
Very good. Any public comments on closed session? Seeing none, this meeting is adjourned.